This is the Bible Show. Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Bible Show. My name is Sam, and joining me today is Will, and we are continuing our series in Genesis. We're going to be doing the second part of chapter 19. Last episode, we talked about the destruction of Sodom, and who was living in Sodom at the time?
Lot.
Lot, who is one of the Lord's redeemed somehow. You know, the Lord is going to capture his heart and soul, maybe after the trauma of today's story, because today's story is really gross. Probably a good parental advisory. You might want to listen to this first before sharing it with younger ears, because there's some problematic
and never
troubling
share
things
with younger ears. Like, if you listen to this and you think maybe my 9-year-old should listen, no, don't.
Yeah, probably not. It's probably not going to put good thoughts in their mind. But ironically, this is really instructive for parenting, as we'll find out, for parents. Mm-hmm. So Lot is living in Sodom, and just to kind of recap and give the arc of Lot's story, we first meet Lot early on in Abraham's story. Abraham had been called out of Haran. Lot is his brother's son, mm-hmm. So Lot is going to be his nephew that he adopts. When God calls him to leave Haran and his father's household and everything else, he takes Lot with him. So Lot is with him when he goes down to Egypt, when he shamefully, you know, betrays Sarah. They come back and God starts blessing their socks off. And we're told that Lot's herdsmen, which means Lot has like a crew. You know, Abraham has like a corporation, or, you know, this little tribe together of his servants and shepherds and everything else going on over here. Well, Lot has his, and we don't think about that in the Sodom story. Like, when Sodom gets destroyed, lots of Lot's guys went with him to Sodom. They're gone, right? So all his hired help, all of his servants, they didn't escape Sodom with him. They got consumed in the Sodom culture or whatever happened to them. But Lot's alone. At first, when Lot goes to Sodom, do you remember what it says? Like, he goes over there because when Abraham and him part, they've got too much wealth, too much blessing to share the same land. So they part ways. Lot's like, I'm after the money. I'm happy to leave. Mm-hmm. And he goes and he sees that the land around Sodom is well watered, like the garden of the Lord, tons of money, tons of industry, merchants everywhere. And he's like, I can really make it over there. So he goes, even though the Bible in Genesis 13 describes Sodom as a wicked place of great sin, even then, he's like, but there's money there. And so it says, does he go live in the city? No,
not at first.
He pitches his tents towards Sodom. So he's compromising. And at this point, like, I don't think he's married. I don't think he has a wife yet. I don't think he has daughters, but it's like, man, you could really make it there. Look at it. Look at, you know, it's the big city. And then the next time you see him, he's captured in Genesis 14, which means he'd gone to be a part of the city.
He's inside the walls.
And then when you meet him in Genesis 19, where is he at?
At the gates.
And what's that mean?
He's an elder. He's the head honcho.
Yeah, he's a big deal. He's like a judge, and he's sitting at the gates, which means that he's an officer. So he's gone from being outside, arm's length, to mucking it up in the city, to now I'm considered one of the bigwigs of the city, right? And he's chasing these dreams. Like, you know, why did he go there? I'm going to make so much money. It's going to be great. While he's there, he takes a wife, is my guess. It's the way I imagine the story anyway. So he takes a wife from Sodom. He raises up a couple of daughters in the city of Sodom. They're about to get married, which in the ancient world means they're probably, what age would you guess?
14, 15-ish.
That's the age in the ancient world. Like, right as soon as you become a teenager, that's when you start being given away in marriage. So remember, Lot leaves with Abraham from Haran. It's 24 years later that Sodom gets destroyed. He's got two teenage daughters. So sometime in Sodom, he builds a family.
Yeah.
We're told that his daughters are virgins. So it's not like he was like, go run wild in the city and live however you want to live. Like, there's some sense which, you know, and he's offended by the actions of the people of Sodom who come and try to rape the angels in Genesis 19. So Lot's got a conscience. But he starts making all these compromises along the way. Mm-hmm. And so think about this as we go through today's passage, like, because the daughters are going to do something that's egregious. Lot is going to do something that's egregious. And you just see, like, if you raise your kids and you expose them to the evils of the world, don't be surprised
when they're evil,
when they act evil in the ways that they've been raised in, right? And so verse 30, just let's enter into Lot's life. He had made it by the standards of the world. All the wealth. He's got the fame. He's got the position. He's got the power in Sodom. And in a moment, right, in a night, all of it's gone. Like, that alone is sobering, right? Like, you can build your whole life. You can chase it down, make a million moral compromises, build up your empire. And God could come in one day and say, it's all gone, right? Because when Lot is leaving the city, remember, he's like, well, I'm not sure, you know, like, let me hang out for a minute. And what do? They grab him by the hand. They grab his daughters by the hand. He grabs his wife by the hand. And they pull him out of the city. So what is Lot not bringing with him?
Anything.
Anything. He is leaving this city. He chased after, left Abraham, left the promises of Abraham and everything else to go to this city to gain all this wealth. And in a moment, he leaves. And the only thing he's got in his hand is the hand of an angel, you know, like saying, I'm taking you out of here. Everything you've built here, gone. It's going to be ash. It's going to be absolutely annihilated. And so you meet him when he's leaving and he's like, the angels say, go to the hills. And he's like, can I at least go to a little city? Like, there's Zoar. It's little. Its name actually means little. Can I, like, please go to a city? Because I'm good at making it in cities. And so they're like, okay. And he goes there and they promise, you know, you'll be safe here. And so it starts in verse 30. We're in 19, verse 30. And it says, now Lot went up out of Zoar and lived in the hills, which is where the angels had told him to go at first. And he said, no, I don't want to go there. It's too dangerous. Lot went up out of Zoar and lived in the hills with his two daughters, for he was afraid to live in Zoar. And you pause there for a moment. And you're like, what does that make you think? Why? Why does he leave Zoar?
Same reason Sodom existed.
Yeah. Like, it makes you wonder, like, what is it in Zoar that he's afraid of? And the Bible doesn't answer this, by the way. So you're left to wonder, like, do the people hate him? Do they find out that he's a Sodomite? Because remember, there's a great outcry to the Lord about what's going on in Sodom.
Like, don't bring that here.
And so he shows up there and they're like, yeah, I know you. You were the guy that sat at the gate. When I brought my caramels, I remember your face. And so maybe they're like, we don't like you. The Lord had told him that he would be safe there, but you see Lot is skittish and he's like, yeah, I'm not sure I can trust that promise. So he bails, you know, and we don't know if it's because he's afraid of the region. We don't know if he's afraid of the people, but he's afraid.
And Lot's interesting because he should be a guy who he's seen God do miraculous things over and over again, right in front of his face. So at this moment, I mean, which we all do this, but like even at the beginning, like, he saw when Sarah was taken to Egypt and God rained down plagues.
Yeah.
He would have thought, Lot would have been like, hey, maybe this is the guy. You know, and then 13, you thought, well, if God could provide for us, why wouldn't he just figure out our wealth too? Just stay with Abraham. He's the guy. He's God's guy. Mm-hmm. And then 14, Abraham's 300 men. That's a miraculous battle. I don't care how well trained they are.
Yep.
I know they blood, sweat, and tears that day. But again, Lot's like, oh, miraculous power of God via the family of Abraham. And time again, you're like, no, hey, wake up here. You just saw Sodom get wiped off the face of the planet. Mm-hmm. If you should be trusting anyone right now, it's the two angels from God who are telling you, this is what you should be doing.
All right, so digging into your idols for a moment.
Yeah.
It's obvious, where does Lot find his safety in the story? Because God, earlier in 19, says you're going to go there, you're going to be safe. And I mean, that could be, you know, safe from the blast, but it's a promise, you're going to be safe there. And he's terrified and leaves. And it makes me wonder, like, why did Lot feel comfortable in Sodom?
Money, for sure.
Money was his fortress.
And power.
Money was a security blanket. Power was his security blanket. So long as he had that, even though the Lord's, you know, not in this awful, wicked place, you know, he's mocked at every turn. Oh, I've got the money. I've got the bank account. I've got the security. I mean, I'm set here. I've got it. Like, my family is considered great. Like, but you take him out of that to where he only has the promise of the Lord and he lives in terror.
Yeah.
He's like, cave. I got to get out of here. I got to get out of here. I'd rather go live in a cave, which is next line. So he lived in a cave with his two daughters. And now, like, the scripture tells you that because you're to think, like, how the mighty have fallen. Think of, you know, you had all this pasture land and tremendous wealth and massive, you know, a massive household, and you roamed and you had it made with Abraham, and you were like, oh, I got to get bigger. I got to get bigger. I got to get bigger. So you chose to walk away from the Lord in a sense and his blessings and his blessed one, Abraham, to go make it on your own. And now you've traded all that. And where do you find yourself? In a cave. And like, do a concordance search or whatever. Search through the Bible at the word cave and see what's going on when you look up caves. Like, it's always people that are running. It's fugitives. It's people who are dead and buried in a cave. There's nothing in a cave that's like, oh, this
well, no
is
one
the
thinks
life.
Of a cave as life, even in our world. Like,
yeah, true.
You know, I think of a cave. It's dark. It's wet. It's where monsters live, you know?
Yeah, right. That's true. Yeah. And so now he's traded all of that. It's the ultimate tragedy that in a night, you know, his circumstances change. And now he finds himself with nothing. He's lost his wife. He's lost his son-in-laws. He's lost all of his business, his wealth, his servants, his household, all of his industry. Everything's gone. And now he's in a cave with nothing but his daughters.
And it gets lower, folks.
Yeah, and it does. Wildly, it gets lower. Like, there's part of me that wishes, like, all right, we'll see you next week. Because this gets really ugly. It's a dark point in Genesis. And it's like, everybody who's listening, if they haven't read the Bible before, is like,
what is about to happen?
Good grit. Like, how much darker does this get? Well,
you think we wouldn't be nervous after last episode? Like,
right?
You think, like, this episode would be like, these guys should be happy-go-lucky. They're not talking about the destruction of Sodom today.
But it's almost like God is saying, like, I want you to be angry at my patience. Like, I want humanity to see how patient I am and how long I'll suffer these people. And I want you to be like, how could you allow this to happen? Like, why would you still call these people your own? Why would you call him righteous Lot? Like, and this will make you angry in your flesh. And yet one of the primary messages out of this is that God knows far more than we do, and he's got a redemptive plan we can't see, which we'll see by the end of this. But that beyond that, like, his mercy is extreme, and we should be grateful for that, because this is us. I mean, we may not do this particular sin. Hopefully nobody listening to this does this particular sin. But whatever sin we are, there's nobody too far that if they grab hold of him can't be redeemed. Like, that's know that going into the story. So verse 31, and the firstborn daughter said to the younger daughter, our father's old. Does that sound familiar? Like, who else is old? Too old, too
Sarah.
Old. It's going to be Sarah. So it's like, you know, our father's old, and what are they worried about? Where are we going to get offspring?
Well, and they're like, my dad's not going to go into a city.
Correct.
My dad's not going to make a business again. No one's going to want to marry me because my dad is the one who left Sodom, mm-hmm. of all places.
And remember what age they are.
Yeah, like, we just lost our fiancés or whatever they were, mm-hmm. back in the story. So they are, I mean, they're vulnerable and they're desperate in this situation, not to excuse anything that'll happen.
Yeah, so they've left the New York City of industry where, yeah, my dad is the big wig.
Yeah, that's Vegas.
Yeah, that is
Vegas.
It's something. But like this, but I'm talking like wealth and everything. Yeah. Like my dad had made it. I'm going to get the cream of the crop, the best selection of the guys of Sodom. All that's been taken away. Now Lot goes to Zoar and they're like looking out for like, okay, who's our husband's going to be here? This is a little podunk, you know, redneck town or something. And now dad is like, no, we're getting away from them too. We can't be around humanity. We're going to go live in a cave isolated all by ourselves, which if you're the daughters, you're like, one, this is the ancient world, so we're not allowed to have an independent life. We have to be under the authority of a man, which right now is our father because we don't have husbands. So now we're following him into isolation where there are no men, which means there will be no husbands, which means there will be no
offspring,
which means that our family will die with us. And so they scheme, right? The firstborn said to the younger, our father is old. He's already losing the ability to chart a course for us, and he's already isolated himself. Like, our days are numbered. Pretty soon we're going to be without a father, without a husband. In the ancient world, that makes us essentially slaves. And there's not a man on earth. Now, that word there can mean earth or in the region. It's Eretz. It can mean both of those things. There's not a man around to come into us after the manner of all the earth. Come, and this is the part that's awful. Come, let us make our father drink wine. We'll get him drunk, and we will lie with him that we may preserve offspring from our father. All right, Will, how you feel about that?
Not good.
gross, like massively, massively gross. And there's something also going on here where, and I don't know the exact meaning of it. Maybe you'd have some insights on the fly, but the last time we had the major judgment story in the Bible, what was it? Genesis chapter 7.
Oh, the flood.
The flood. What happens right as soon as that judgment's over? Noah plants a vineyard and gets
drunk,
plastered. And it's some event that happens when he's plastered and he's laid naked and he's uncovered in his tent that his offspring, the three boys, one of them mocks him, and it results in this tragedy and a cursed line coming out, the line of Canaan that will be cursed as a result of the sin or whatever happens there. And so now you have another great judgment where God's wrath breaks forward. And what do you see? The person who's delivered out of that wrath is going to be drunk again. So it's like, wow, that's a little on the nose. Where's he getting the wine, by the way? Like, there's commentaries in the old rabbis. They'd be like, they used to, because this is true. Like, we just went to Italy not long ago, and some of the wineries over there, guess where they keep their wine?
The caves.
They keep them down in caves because they're cool and they preserve it better. And it's like they serve as kind of natural places. So it's possible that they showed up in this cave and they're like, oh, these are the nice caves of the wine of Sodom that I knew about. And well, let's make a home there. Could be. Well, we don't know.
Or after a worldwide judgment, a little time you're in Zoar, you're trying to find something.
Yeah, true.
You're a little stressed. There's a lot on your plate. It's a lot.
That's true.
If anyone wants to disassociate from life right now via alcohol, it's a lot.
Yeah. Imagine the pain and regret and remorse and how upside down everything is right now. He's got to be wondering, like, am I lost? Like, is God displeased with me? I mean, they did rescue me, and yet, like, I've lost everything.
Angels aren't still here.
Yeah. So they're looking to preserve offspring from their father by getting them drunk. And so right after the story of Noah, you have Noah gets drunk and it's like the world falls all over again. Well, Lot has just been delivered. And yet that legacy of sin, that legacy of selfishness that he's now created in his daughters by raising them up in Sodom is now about to come and haunt him. Like, his failures as a dad are about to be visited upon him. You know, the natural consequences of those bad choices.
And I know it says they made him drink wine, but I'm not getting the picture. Yeah, they tied him up, put a funnel down his mouth. It seems like Lot was willing to drink to excess.
Yeah, correct. I totally agree with that, because if he was unwilling, he would have woken up after the first night and have been like, oh, my head, you know, I've got this hangover. What in the world did you do? And there would be discipline down on his 13, 14, 15-year-old daughters, and it wouldn't happen again. But it happens again. So he's like, please, hey, just medicate me out. I'm ready to go again. And so they get him drunk with the motive that they're going to sleep with him to preserve their line. And so they made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father. Now listen to what it says. He did not know when she lay down or when she arose. Now, what do we know? The first time we get introduced to Lot's daughters, just to highlight how Lot has corrupted them, what's the first time you remember Lot's daughters being mentioned in the Bible?
As the pawn to satiate the crowds.
That's right. Remember when the people of Sodom are banging on the door and they're demanding that the two men, the two angels, come out? Lot's like, hey, I've got two daughters. And so, like, you think about, like, they're there. These houses are not massive in the ancient world.
They
hear this, right? So the value of their sexual identity, of what they've seen in Sodom and they've heard come out of their dad's mouth, like, they don't have boundaries. They don't see sex as being this unbelievably valuable, beautiful, sacred gift from God to a culture. Our culture treats it like a carnival act or like it's some kind of a game. But I've said this, I may have said this before on the podcast, but sex is the one gift that God gives to humanity that brings about something that's eternal, that is created out of nothing. Like the union of marriage, a man and a woman coming together. Think about this. I mean, if I make a painting, the painting's going to decompose. It's going to rot. It's going to go into the ground, whatever. But when Laura and I get married and we give birth to Caleb, Caleb's an immortal creature, right? He's going to live forever. Jacob, Leah, Nathan, like, they all go on. They will live forever. They are eternal creatures. And God empowers. Of course, he has to be involved in a sovereignty to bless it. But God empowers the act of sex to bring about a living being that will live forever. And we're like, cool. Whatever. I'm going to go out to the bar tonight. Like, and it's he's like, whoa, like the most powerful gift I could possibly bestow upon humanity to bring about another soul. And you guys cheapen it like this? How gross. How gross. And so he's trained them up in a city that sees sex as absolutely repulsive. And then he's willing to offer them up. I read one commentary. Now this, I don't believe this, but I'm going to throw it out there. There was a commentary that said that Lot did that to preserve everybody, that it was really righteous motives that he said, hey, you can have my daughters, because he knew they were all homosexual.
Oh.
Right. Which, you know, come on. And so he knew that they would decline the daughters because the entire city is homosexual only. And it's like, okay, if they're all homosexual,
that city how are they
repopulating? Yeah, yeah. Like, so anyway, people are desperate to try to clean the Bible up. And it's like, no, they're messy. They're really messy. So anyway, that's what happens here. Really disturbing.
Yeah, Lot thought he left Sodom behind, but Sodom followed him.
That's right. That's right. And as you'll see, part of their motive is going to be, we want Sodom to continue. I think that's part of it. So anyway, he doesn't know. He wakes up, no idea. How drunk is he?
I mean, yeah.
Gone. Blacked out, no memory. Like, in my past life, before becoming a Christian, I had a problem with alcohol. And I've experienced blackouts to where it's like, I'm going about my day. I don't feel great because I've been an idiot the night before. And then I find out something I said to somebody, and it's like, I have no memory of that. It's a terrifying experience. And so, like this, he has absolutely no memory of this. And all of a sudden, they're living in a cave, and his daughters get pregnant. Like,
4 months in, he's like,
what?
It's like, you guys,
all right, we got something to share with you, Dad. Like, we don't know when he finds out. But this is very awkward. So, verse 34, the next day, the firstborn said to the younger, not, oh my gosh, I feel awful. My conscience is destroying me. I can't believe that I just did that to Dad. No. The firstborn says to the younger, behold, I lay last night with my father. Let us make him drink wine tonight also. Then you go in and lie with him, that we may preserve our offspring from our father.
So they know Lot's good for a pattern.
Yeah.
Like, they know Lot's not going to pick up on it. They've seen Dad do this before.
Yeah. And man, there's no conscience here. There's no regret whatsoever. It's shocking. Like, and I think this is where it gets to be like, it is so shocking to read these stories that we kind of want to like ignore them and be like, la, 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 the people in the Bible are really good. And, you know, there are examples of behavior and we need to follow after them. And God's going, they are not the heroes of this story. Like,
no,
they're really messy and they're a big work in progress and they step in it a lot and they mess up a lot. And the ones who come to me for mercy are still mine. And you're like, I'm not sure I like that. Like, I want, no, don't do this. Like, whoosh. And there's going to be justice. There's consequences from all this action, just like there's consequences for Lot right now from what he did for the decade before this. But, you know, I remember I told this story a long time ago, but one of my friends had an older son who went over to Ukraine to meet his fiance, and he was going to marry her. And while he was over there, he ended up getting killed. This is long before the war broke out. So I don't know, 20 years ago or so. But his fiance was devastated by this. Obviously he was a Christian. She was not, or at least was tinkering with it. And she was like, she wanted to talk with me as a pastor to talk about heaven and like, what do you believe about where he is? How do I get where he is? Will I ever see him again? All those kinds of questions. And so we talk and I'm explaining the gospel to her, like, you know, this is what the Christian believes, that there is a path to heaven, to the Father, that runs through Christ, and his mercy and grace is available to anybody who gives their life to him. And so she's like, I want to know more about this. And I said, so, okay, this is what I want you to do. I want you to go and I want you to read the gospel of John.
Okay.
And I want you to read through Genesis. And so, I don't know, like 2 weeks later, we talk. And she's like, I'm always bad at the accent.
You don't have to do it. You know that, right?
I feel like I have
to. You don't have to do the accent.
I loved your Jesus, whatever. You know. But she's like, I love your Jesus. Like, he is so good and he's so kind and it's so wonderful. But I read, then I read Genesis and I hate this book. Like, I hate it. Like, and she was astonished that this was our holy book. Like, and that these like
those are in the same book?
Yeah. These are the people you lift up. Like, have you read it? Like, she was in awe that this is our holy book. Cause it's like, you realize like every character screws up. Like every character is a mess. Every character is fumbling and bumbling and mistreating one another. And they're messy as can be. And it's like, yes, you know, it is kind of startling. And if you read Genesis without it, then it's like, oh, a whole bunch of moral examples, which there are those in the Bible for sure. But these are not the heroes of the story.
No,
they're not. And it's almost like God gives us this chapter, this book, to shock us into the realization that man does not deserve his grace or mercy or his favor. He is the good one. We are not. And so we have to throw ourselves at his mercy. And he gives us shocking stories like that to really drill it home. So verse 35, it says, so they made their father drink wine that night also, and the younger arose and lay with him. And he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. And thus both the daughters of Lot became pregnant by their father. Wow. I mean, just wow. You know, there's other examples of this in the Bible, like when you think, not this particular thing, but where a parent raises up their kids and the little things that they bring their kids into, you're like, oh, they're just repeating the sins that they saw dad do. Mm. One of the ones that hit me the hardest was the story of David. Like if you read that story, like David is this wonderful guy, right? Man after God's own heart. Writes half of the Psalms. He's a guy that loves God. He's a charitable guy. When he becomes king, people are rejoicing because he's looking after the little guy and he's showing mercy and justice to those that are far off. And then he gets really powerful. And what happens to him?
Becomes lazy.
And that's Lot again here. Like the moment you get everything that your flesh wants, the wealth and the power and everything else, David becomes this horrible figure that goes out onto his roof while his troops are in battle. He sees a woman bathing and he's like, oh, she's attractive. I'll take her. And they're like, well, that's Uriah's wife. And he's like, I don't care. I want her.
One of your mighty men, by the way, yeah. Sir.
Yeah. One of your greatest, closest people who would lay down his life for you in a heartbeat. And he's like, I don't care. I want her. And so he takes her, and then he has Uriah killed, and he lies about it, and he brings shame to the name of God. He does all these things. And then when you read later, like his kids, he's got a number of kids, and the way that they behave, he's got a kid who rapes his half-sister Tamar, Amnon. You know that story? Mm-hmm. And it's like, where did he learn that, David? Or Adonijah, who does unbelievable things, or Absalom, who just takes whatever he wants when he wants. And it's like, how in the world can the kids of David... And it's like, man, all the sins that they do, he did. And in fact, Solomon, when he shows his wisdom, and not to go too far down this rabbit trail, but when Solomon shows his wisdom with the two prostitutes and he says, bring me the sword when they're arguing over the one child, like Solomon's wisdom comes from the Lord, who after David had behaved wickedly and was denying paternity over Solomon or the child that would die by Bathsheba, what did God say? What did Nathan say? Bring me... Like, there's a sword that will not depart from your house. Hmm. Solomon's like, bring me the sword. There's all that to say, the children follow the example set by the parents in a lot of cases. Not always, but in a lot of cases. And here, everything that Lot had compromised with, you're watching the daughters just exude it. And they've become Sodom.
Yeah, also just even how the culture affects our kids. I mean, I work with students. I mean, that's my primary role is middle school and high school. And it's like, parents, if you're not teaching your kids something, the world is. And now they're so much more connected. They know so much more than ever before. They can see to the darkest corners of the world at all times with the thing in their pocket. And if that's not fought against, that's what they're going to become because that's what they're being taught by.
Yeah. And I'll say this. My generation... and the generation before me, I'll say that too, failed to really hold up biblical examples of the gospel and real virtue and ethics. and the next generation that came along, like you look at all the fruits of what this generation's carrying, all the mental health studies, the skyrocketing anxiety rates that come with things like the phone, but also what we're teaching them and stripping them of the hope of the gospel. We're not giving them foundations that there's a God who loves them and cares for them and sees them as valuable and their values not conditional upon their performance or their wealth or their circumstances. Like their values unconditional because they're made in the image of God and they're purchased by God at the cost of his own son. If we gave our kids that understanding of who they were, they wouldn't have the depth of mental issues that they do now. And here's the good news. If you're one of the parents out there that's like, yeah, but this could be awkward, this generation that's coming up right now, this Gen Z generation that's coming out of high school and in high school right now and in college, they're turning around. Like, it's the first generation that we've seen for several decades where church attendance is tracking up, where Bible sales just set a record. I saw in the Wall Street Journal that Bible sales last year was up 22%. That's always the number one book in the world. To jump 22% is off the charts. That they're far more open to it, that there you see these revivals breaking around on college campuses, and you see it in college athletics. You see it all over the place, and in all the surveys that they're doing, all of a sudden, this younger generation is looking at what they've been handed by previous generations, which is a philosophic system of death and emptiness. Mm. Like, this is what the world is all about, and you know, all this crazy woke stuff that's obsessed with victimhood and vilifying everybody, like, and that's become their entire world, and the world is hopeless because of global warming and everything else, and everybody heaps this despair on this generation with no sense of hope that goes beyond this life or this world, and we wonder, gee, I wonder why they're crumbling. And right now, thank God, it seems like this younger generation is saying, no thanks, we're done. We don't want Sodom anymore. We want to look for a city whose builder and architect is God. We want to be on team Abraham. We're done with Sodom because that's what this world has given the last few generations, and it's crushed them. And I hope they vomit it out and reject it because it's gross. It's death. It's awful. Nobody should swallow that. All right, so now that I'm off my soapbox for that moment, but I really do mean that. Like, parents, teach your kids that they're loved by God. Teach them the truths of the scripture. It will bless them. It will really bless them. On our other show, Under the Hood, we did a series how, you know, being in the faith blesses young people. Parents who raise their kids, it opens up so many positive benefits for those kids that go beyond eternal salvation. Like, if you love your kid, expose them to these things. It will help them in life, even physiological and medical. So check out our other YouTube channel, Under the Hood. If you doubt me, watch those episodes. It's fascinating to see how being raised up with faith benefits you every conceivable way of your soul, your body, your mind, your heart, all of it.
It's wild.
Yeah. So, all right, verse 37, back to the text. The firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. So what does Moab mean? Do you know? It's,
I don't know, like, not off the top of my head.
It's of my father, I think, is where it comes from. Like, the M sound is from, so it's from the father, I think, is literally
Moab what it means. Sounds like the Hebrew for from father.
From the father, yeah. So, I mean, like, if you're walking around and the kid's name is from the father, you're like, oh, your father. But behind that is like a double entendre that here's the daughter who's having a son
from her
by
father.
The father. It's from the father. Like, so
ooh, that cave got weird real quick, you know?
Pretty gross.
Who's dad?
Yeah.
Who's grandpa? Oh, wait.
Yeah.
They're the same. What do you think they called him?
What? Oh, like dad or grandpa? I've never thought of that. That's disturbing. I don't know.
Give me an end. No, just kidding.
Dappa. I don't know.
This is breaking our podcast.
Anyway, it is. Thank you for that. All right, so he is the father of the Moabites to this day. Hang on to that. That'll be important. And verse 38, the younger also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ammi. Now, there's different theories as to why this name literally means son. So Ben in Hebrew is the son.
Of course.
And Ammi means of my people. And so here there's one commentator who says Sodom was reborn that night in that cave. And so when she says, you know, his name will be Ben-Ammi, here you have Lot's daughter born to a Sodomite wife, raised up in the city of Sodom. She's just watched all of her people decimated. Now she has a son and says, son of my people.
It's like a real villain story.
What is that? It's like everything that was just wiped out in Sodom, I'm going to give birth to it again. Like, is that it? Or is she like, I don't think she's pointing to Abraham's line or the paternal line that goes back to Abraham's father. It's possible.
I never even met Abraham, I bet.
Yeah, not that, I mean, unless, you know, when, if Lot had kids, maybe by the time he brought them home from the rescue, I don't, but other than that, probably not. So, Ben Ami, son of my people. So here you see, like, this is almost, you get a sense they're wicked. Like, they're really wicked.
Well, their first thought was, let's take advantage of that. I mean, there could have been side conversations that we don't know recorded, but the Bible tells us.
I'll say this. They're all wicked, but these are not redeemed. Like, we have no sense that the daughters of Lot are going to be redeemed, other than the fact that they were pulled out by the angels. Like, other than that, these lines, the Moabites and the Ammonites, are going to be, because Ben-Ami, he says he is the father of the Ammonites to this day. So the Moabites and the Ammonites come from Lot and his two daughters, and these are going to be major players for the rest of Scripture, and that they are always a thorn in the side of Israel. They will always be the enemy of the people of God.
Yeah, read some of those verses you sent me today.
Yeah, so, all right, let's just jump there. Yeah. So Amos is a prophet, right? Listen to what the Ammonites used to do. And by the way, both of them will develop gods, Shamash and Molech, that to worship him, you had to take your children and throw them into the fires of worship. So what, you know, we talked about the theory, like what was the great sin of Sodom? You know, they exploited children. If you haven't watched that episode, go back and watch it. But there's a theory that that's what they did. To initiate you into citizenship, they would exploit children, right? So what does it yield now? Lot's daughters then produce tribes that their primary form of worship is what? Taking their children and slaughtering them to their God. So it's like, again, the children are being exploited by these people. And in Amos chapter 1, verse 13, just talking about the Ammonites, and God's listing out the transgressions for which they're going to be punished. And he says, I will not revoke the punishment because they have ripped open pregnant women in Gilead just to enlarge their border. So they're actually going to women who are pregnant and ripping them open so that they can kill their babies while the mothers watch. Like, the Ammonites are wicked, wicked people. In Ezekiel, it says, chapter 25, starting at verse 1, God speaking to him, son of man, set your face toward the Ammonites and prophesy against them. Say to them, hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord God, because you said, aha, over my sanctuary when it was profaned and over the land of Israel when it was made desolate and over the house of Judah when they went into exile. So the Ammonites are always like, the Israelites got conquered. Their temple got torn down. Ha, 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 ha. And God's like, they are not my people. It was the Moabites and the Ammonites that fought Jehoshaphat, if you've ever heard that name, king of Judah. Like, they're the ones who came to fight against him. They're always the bad guys. The Moabites wanted their prophets to curse Israel. One of the very first, and when they came out of Egypt, one of the very first kingdoms to enslave the Israelites again was the Moabite king Eglon. Remember him?
Yep.
The big fat guy, like, gets stabbed and all the poo comes out. Book of Judges, you're welcome. But, like, again and again and again, the Moabites were trying to entice the Israelites to come and sleep with their daughters and worship their gods. They were like, hey, come worship our, hear this, sound familiar, come worship our gods and you can sleep with our daughters. We'll give you our daughters. That's Numbers 25. And they were trying to entice Israel away from the Lord by doing that. Like, they're always gross. They stink. They're awful. And so, like, then this begs the question, why in the world does God not just take the Ammonites and Moabites and go, whoosh, done?
That's what we want.
What's the answer? Why would God sustain the Moabites?
I mean, the redemption part of the story.
Which is what? Go for it.
Which is, you know, Lot's story ends. We don't hear from Lot again.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The book of Genesis just moves on. So all that we know for Lot's end is that he's a broken, shattered man raising his two grandsons with his two daughters who took advantage of him in a cave outside of Zoar. And you're like, ah, that's awful. Like, nothing good can come from this. And then you read all those verses about the Moabites and Ammonites, and you're like, well, there's no hope for those people either. And then you get to the book of Ruth. Mm-hmm. And the book of Ruth opens up, and it has Naomi and her husband and her two sons who shockingly, like the story of Abraham and Sarah, there's a famine in the land and they have a decision to make. They live in Bethlehem and it's their time to say, hey, we're going to stay with the people of God or we're going to go and seek after food. And they go into the land of Moab. And there, Naomi and her two sons find wives, Ruth and, what's the other one, Orpah?
So yeah, the sons
marry Moabite women.
Correct.
In Moab, who one of the daughter-in-laws of Naomi,
Naomi
is Ruth.
And, or Ruth and Orpah. Yeah.
And this so happens, after they get married, the father dies, so Naomi's husband dies, and then her two sons die. So now we got three widows. Two are from Moab, one's from Bethlehem. And Naomi's like, okay, girls, go. Like, there's no hope for all three of us together. Like, I'm going to go back to my homeland, but you guys should just go back to your stay here in Moab. It'll be better for you. Because if you come back to Bethlehem with me, I mean, I have nobody.
And not only that, but if you come back into Bethlehem and you're like, hey, I'm a Moabitess, everybody's going to be like, gross, because we know you people. You're evil to the core. You sacrifice your children. Your legacy comes out of incest. You're sexually promiscuous. You're known for that. You're the children of Sodom, essentially. And this is why, like, Ruth, if you're thinking, okay, Lot's daughters were, like, they were scheming. They were like, and I'm going to use sexuality however I can to get ahead and do all these things, and it's all about me and me, me, me. Ruth, on the other hand, when she's given the option of looking at her mother-in-law, Naomi, who's in real dire straits as an elderly widow, what is Ruth does something that's totally unlike the Moabites, right?
Yeah, she goes with her.
Yeah. Where you go, I go.
Yeah, that famous line of, where you go, I go.
Yeah. My lot is your lot. Like, I will be the hated foreigner in your land, but I'm not going to leave your side. I'm not going to exploit. I'm not going to cheat. I'm not going to, you know, use circumstances. In fact, I'm leaving the Sodomite line. I want to be grafted into your line.
Yeah, she says,
I want back in the line of Abraham.
Like, your God will be my God, even in that famous text that she says.
Yeah. So now you've got a child of Sodom.
Who's like, I'm rejecting it now.
I don't want it. I don't want it. I'll take the poverty. Hear the anti-ethic there? Like, Lot's all like, money, 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 money. And she's like, I'll leave it all. I'll leave it all. I'm leaving everything I'm comfortable with. I'll be like Abraham. I will leave the land of my fathers. I'll leave everything I know. I'll leave everything because I'm going to chase after your God. I want to be grafted into the family of Abraham. I want to leave the line of Sodom. And so Ruth, who does she meet?
Boaz. Well, at first, their story is very vulnerable. They're just like paupers in the field. They're just like, hopefully they don't get taken advantage of by these people, but they meet Boaz.
Boaz has to tell his guys, don't touch them.
Yeah, they're safe.
Because women are so vulnerable in the ancient world. He has to give instructions to the workers in the field. They're not to be touched.
Yeah, because the field workers would go through, and then people who were in poverty levels would then go and glean whatever was left over, whatever the bad stuff was, or the stuff that they just forgot. So it was in that moment that they meet the real owner of this land, Boaz, who happens to be a relative of Naomi. And what's that title called? What's this?
Kinsman Redeemer.
Kinsman Redeemer.
Yeah, so what ends up happening is you have Ruth, who's going out and collecting up meals to make sure that Naomi gets fed. Naomi's not out there doing it, but she catches Boaz's eye. And what ends up happening is he starts giving her all these special favors, paying special attention to her, and Naomi's like, hey, like, I think there might be something going on here. And so she sets up a circumstance where Ruth has to go to Boaz, and eventually, like, Boaz is totally interested in her. He's such an honorable man, just a good man.
Yet every turn honorable. When you're kind of braced for, like, someone to do something bad,
This
is the one story where that just doesn't happen.
Yeah, so there are stories in the Bible where you're like, oh, this is a good role
model.
This
is a whole book. It's just four chapters long.
Yeah. This is good. And so what ends up happening in the ancient world as protections for widows, because if a man died, the property rights and everything else went into limbo because it had to be a man that owned the land. You could pass it on to a woman. She had to get remarried. And so one of the things is, if she had debts or she whatever, you could have a kinsman redeemer who would be the closest relative that would come along and say, I'll redeem it all and restore their fortunes. And so what ends up happening is Boaz says, I'll be your kinsman redeemer.
And he's not the one closest, right? So he has to go and, like, make it happen.
Yeah, so he goes to somebody and he's like, do you want to redeem it? No? Okay, then I will. He ends up marrying Ruth. They have a son whose name is Obed. Obed has a son whose name is Jesse. Jesse has a son whose name is
King David.
King David. And so this is the messianic line. It's the Messiah, the Savior of the world, is going to be called the Son of David, right? Mm. And so I want you to think about this. Like, when you're wondering, why on earth does God not just look at this and go, I'm done, I'm going to squash all of this wickedness? Guess, in the lineage of Lot, inside Lot and inside one of his daughters is the genealogical genetic material, right, that's going to lead you to David. That's weird to think about. Mm-hmm. That's going to lead you to Jesus. And so even in the most corrupt, most disgusting, most despicable evils that humanity is up to, God is stirring around and he is bringing about something that will bring about the salvation of the world, that will make it available to everybody who's wicked, all the people that are corrupt, all the bad parents, all the bad kids, all the bad sodomites, all the bad whatever, that if they just come to the place where they say, like Ruth, I don't want to be a part of that tribe anymore. Mm. Like, I want to follow the God of Abraham. Where you go, I go. My life is your life. Your wealth, my wealth. Like, I'm all in. It's all you. Like, I'm chasing after you. Then God's grace provided by Jesus, who God came into this world, died for his people, took our sins, our shames, our worst things, and he can take an entire tribe of people that is absolutely atrociously wicked all through the Old Testament, and even out of that, bring about redemption and beauty.
Yes.
And salvation. And it's like, at the end of the day, you look at him and you're like, you are so good to people who do not deserve it. So good. And to rescue, you know, along the way, rescuing people like Ruth and Naomi, and using noble people who are heroic in the story, like Boaz, you know, like, it's just fun. Because every time we come to a story like this, I'm a pastor, which, you know, I shouldn't admit this, but there's like, there's part of me where my finger wants to come up and be like, you shouldn't show them mercy. This is too far. This is too far gone.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be kind. You shouldn't be patient anymore. And it's like it outdoes itself every time. And it's like, and then of course you got to remember, like, oh yeah, you know, I need that level of patience. I need that level of mercy.
Yeah, I love that Lot's story ends. And if you just read your Bible, you know, from page one to the end, like, that's the last you hear of Lot until you get the New Testament. Mm-hmm. And you're not expecting it, but all of a sudden Jesus is saying, like, oh, a pattern of God's loving redemption for all of us is his deliverance of Lot. Mm-hmm. And then you get to Peter, and all Peter says is righteous Lot and yeah. Lot's righteous soul. And
yeah. You're like, huh?
And it's not like, it doesn't give us a background. Like, this is what happened to make Lot righteous again. Yeah. It's saying, no, like, Lot's sin, Jesus, other side of that, we can now say righteous Lot.
Yeah. Because of him.
Yeah.
You know, there's one thing I remember, and I think this is a helpful point when we think about the righteousness of God versus our wickedness. Because, like, we can say, yeah, we need mercy too, just like Sodom. But the reality is, like, in our hearts, we're like, we're way better than Sodom. We are so much better than Lot's daughters. We are so much better than Judas and Hitler and Stalin and all these really, really terrible figures. And it's like, comparatively, if I'm looking at you and it's like, okay, you know, I take care of my family and I do this and that, and I don't commit genocides and, you know, I'm not sleeping with my mom or dad. Like, you know, like, I'm a pretty good person. And that would be true if we looked at it comparatively. But when you consider who God is, right? He's not just a little bit more righteous than Sam and Will.
Yeah.
In his attributes, how righteous is he? Infinitely so, right? So if I were to ask you, and this, it's all a matter of perspective. So we're in South Florida. So if I said to you, you know, what's the distance between Fort Lauderdale and Miami? It's like, I mean, it's not too far. 30, 40 miles, 20 miles. I don't even know. It's not too far, right? But it's comparatively. Then if I said, you know, what about from, if I'm looking at a map, what's the distance between Fort Lauderdale and Miami? It's this much, right?
Yeah.
Because I'm way higher looking down at a map where it's this much. God is infinitely righteous, right? So imagine being in another galaxy, looking toward Earth, being like, how close are Fort Lauderdale and Miami? You'd be like, I can't even see them. Like they're essentially they the exist, same yeah. thing. Like they're so much beneath this infinitely high creature that to try to differentiate them at that distance, they're the same thing essentially, right? Mm-hmm. So now imagine you standing next to Hitler and Stalin and the worst figures in human history, okay? Human perspective, you're light years awesome. Apart. You are amazing. But now give someone who's got an infinite height to their righteousness, looking down from galaxies away, to use steal the metaphor. What's the distance between you and a Hitler next to God's infinite, never-ending?
Microscopic, if you could even give it a name.
Microscopic difference when you're standing next to the righteousness of God. That sounds so offensive to our ears. How dare you say that I'm like that? But next to an infinitely righteous God, the difference between you and God is infinitely greater than the difference between you and Hitler. Truth? Would you deny that?
No, I don't like it, but yeah.
I don't like it either. And yet he bridges that entire chasm to make you righteous enough for him. Yes. Now, what's the difference between going this far to get you and going this far to get Lot's, a person like Lot? We don't understand how amazing grace is. And when we start pointing fingers at how God's patience reaches this far, when we're like, you know, it's good that you come and get me when I'm like this much above.
I'm one ladder rung up.
We should marvel at God's goodness. And we should never feel that we're more entitled to it than someone else, because it's all a gift. Yeah. It's all grace. It's all mercy. It's all undeserved. And the fact that he comes into our messes and makes beautiful things out of it, that's a comfort.
Yeah.
Because I got lots of messes in my past, and I've seen some of them made really beautiful.
Yeah.
He's good like that. Amen?
Amen.
All right, well, next time we're going to get out of all these the crazy parts.
You could watch
of this.
Next episode.
Yeah, next time, bring your kids. So we'll be doing Genesis 20, where you're going to see Abraham have flashes of something beautiful, but another stumble that's pretty remarkable and stunning again. But you see God do something that's really beautiful in the way he instructs how we are to interact with the rest of the world as people of God. So join us next time as we go further into the book of Genesis with Genesis chapter 20. God bless. Thanks for listening to The Bible Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to like and subscribe and leave a kind review to help us in the world of tech algorithms. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Bible Show.